I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
That is exactly what I needed to hear.
Thank God someone here knows what they're talking about.
That's us. That's right. Gotta love this American ride. All
right, you need to take the time and get the full picture.
Come on, come on. Turn the radio on a Saturday and I won't be long.
Don't get me wrong. I love the ladies. I mean, they rev my engine, but they don't belong in the newsroom. It is Anchor Man, not Anchor Lady.
What do you want from me? I'm not America's sweetheart.
Goodness sake, kid. Keep your voice down. Your father's listening to the radio.
I'm not America's sweetheart.
This is the Annie Fry Show.
Minorities are growing sick of the rhetoric on the left. We're being tired of used as voting mules every 4 years, being told, oh my gosh, racism is back, white supremacy is back, and our communities are not getting better. This is the first time that we are seeing Black Americans and Hispanic Americans get off of their feet. And though the media is trying to use a bunch of rhetoric to distract us and pulling apart pieces and sound bites of things that Trump said, trying to create something that he never meant, it's not going to work this time.
Candace Owens reacting to the difference in this upcoming election, maybe even starting with the 2016 election, and how people of non-white skin, I guess, are going to be activated in a different way going into 2020. And it makes me think about, she uses the word rhetoric. It's a great word for it, because rhetoric is a sentence that someone has put together and fashioned exactly how you feel good when you hear it, or you feel angry when you, but the important thing is you feel whatever the person speaking the rhetoric wants you to feel. That's the point of using rhetoric instead of speaking in truth and facts. Or if you're Joe Biden, truth over facts. Isn't that what he said?
Truth before facts.
Yeah. Truth over facts.
Truth over facts.
Yeah.
And it's got to be your truth.
Yeah. Yeah. Truth is not relative. Truth is truth.
Got to be your facts.
When you think about rhetoric, it's a very political, politically involved thing. And I was laughing my head off today listening to it. Did we share the Johnny Cash thing?
Not yet.
We can get that.
Yeah,
well,
the best way to describe this is a little slice of heaven.
I heard so my.
This is a whole montage video of Johnny Cash's song "Hurt," and all of the Democratic candidates in Iowa eating all of the fried stuff. It's like
they are miserable.
Fried chicken, fried Twinkies.
There was a
dogs.
Pork chop.
Yeah, and it's like it's a very appropriate song to play with all of these Democratic candidates biting into fried butter. But I'll do this for your vote. Mm-hmm. If this makes me relatable to you, I'll do it.
They're eating it and they are swarmed by cameras. Just click, 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 click of them eating like a giant turkey leg.
I do not need slow-mo Pete Buttigieg eating a turkey leg or slow-mo Bill de Blasio eating a corn dog. I don't need it. It doesn't need to be a part of my memory. I can't handle it. But the Bill de Blasio one is the longest one. There's Kamala Harris. Bernie Sanders eats something and his eyes get like super wide and you don't know if he's like going into cardiac arrest or he's like, well, these are really delicious. This tastes like fried food. Just like everything else here, it tastes fried food. That's what a state fair is. There's a lot of fried food.
Bill de Blasio of New York City.
How is Randy Quaid?
I hope he's doing great.
I bet he's doing great.
I bet he is. As if Trump's going to stop tweeting anytime soon. He's right. Got lots of material to work with.
I wonder, whenever someone sees a presidential candidate eating something fried, are they like, yep, That's a regular person. Let's vote for that person.
I think that was probably much more effective as close as 10 years ago. But when you consider 20 years ago, when you like, okay, Tony, you might remember this. I remember this, but I probably know this more from watching it over again in some sort of like 90s special or something.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Clinton going on Arsenio Hall. Wasn't it Arsenio Hall?
Playing the saxophone. Oh, yeah.
It's like the epitome, the beginning of how relatable of a dude can I be.
If you watch like documentaries of that election and how he was
cool,
like a distant third, and people didn't think he really had a chance at even getting the nomination. And then they talk about some of the things he did to win the nomination, then of course go on to win the presidency. The Arsenio Hall play the saxophone with sunglasses on is like a moment. It's like
pivotal moment.
It's literally a piece of American history. It was a pivotal moment exactly in that election. It was a big deal.
And the whole thing.
And all it did, it was made him relatable. That's
talking about? Have you ever seen this?
I don't think I have.
Okay. So for people who don't know, Katie's 26 years old. This is a fun moment every time this comes up in the show where I'm aware of it because I've studied it, or I was old enough to know things were going on, but not old enough to care.
Mm-hmm.
Tony is, you're 41.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 35. You're 26.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got the 40s, the 30s, and the 20s here. And Bill Clinton's presidency was happening when you were born.
Yes, basically. Yep.
Mm-hmm. I'm a Reagan baby. You would be Carter? Do you know who's president?
Carter.
Bill Clinton went on to Arsenio Hall. Do you know who Arsenio Hall is? You know what that is?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you thought it was whoop. There it is.
That's
so I have to clarify these
things. That's fine.
There's definitely
clarity
an M
is always good.
In whoop.
Clarity is always good.
It's different. He goes on Arsenio Hall and he puts on, like Tony said, sunglasses and he plays the saxophone. We're talking about Ronald Reagan. Like, just to hear the soothing voice of Ronald Reagan say anything, it's like people don't talk like that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Barack Obama has the ability to be an orator in a way that is smooth to the ear. Unfortunately, what he says is painful to the brain. But he goes, so Bill Clinton strips apart all of the policy and he goes all politics and becomes super relatable. He became America's first black president because of stuff like that. Did that stem specifically from the Arsenio Hall appearance when he started to be referred to as that?
As what?
The first black president?
Yes, I think so.
This happened.
I think maybe somebody like Arsenio Hall.
This happened June 1992, so I wasn't even born yet.
Yeah
it happened on June 3rd, 1992. And I wanted to know that date, so I just looked it up. And what popped up was a list compiled by CBS News, I don't know when, but not that long ago, of iconic presidential campaign moments. And Bill Clinton plays the sax is number 3.
What are the other two?
On their list. Number one is Truman holding up the newspaper, Dewey Defeats Truman. So there you go. If number one is Dewey Defeats Truman, and number 3 is Clinton plays the sax, it shows you how big of a deal that moment was considered. Number 2 was when is Clint Eastwood talks to the empty chair.
No, really? Do you remember this from the last RNC?
And
that was
four
bizarre.
Number 4 is I Like Ike. Yeah.
So
yeah, that was bizarre. Talking to the empty chair.
When you
I don't know if it's number 2, but it's weird.
Think about how far we've come from Bill Clinton playing the saxophone on Arsenio Hall to how much effort is put into being relatable. And the big difference there is technology. It's the fact that in my back pocket, literally right now, I have a better camera than could have even been dreamt of in the 80s and the 90s on my phone. I can do my own live broadcast. I do on my Facebook page, which now has 8,000 likes. Thanks, guys. I screenshot the Facebook page last night and drew a mustache on myself. Did you see that?
I did. Mm-hmm.
Because we had 7,999 likes.
Come on.
Like, is there one soul out there?
Is there one?
And we got one. So thank you for being there on the Facebook page. But when you look at the relatability, how valuable is relatability in an actual president?
Huge.
How important is it when it comes to being able to do your job, being qualified? Not to get
not
there. Once you're there, mm-hmm.
yeah.
how much do I care if mm-hmm. I feel like you were just like me? Nada.
Not at all.
I don't want you to be just like me.
But a lot of people do.
Yeah. You should see me getting my children ready in the morning. I am not mentally in the state of mind to be handling stress at 7 a.m. at this point. Maybe after my vacation hangover is over.
I would say that it has a lot to do with why George W. Bush was elected president. Is that people found him relatable. They found, remember that was when the whole, like, I just.
And Al Gore was like a robot.
I'd love to have a beer with him. That mm-hmm. was the whole thing. I'd love to have a beer with him.
Same with Obama.
Yeah, he was.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I would like to spend time with Obama and be like, let's sit down and talk about some things.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk to you about this. I feel like I would enjoy that conversation. I feel like I would like to sit down with Donald Trump, but I don't feel as though we would have a conversation where he's not doing the Donald Trump thing.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I think he's in control. I think when he goes from room to room, he understands how to work a room. He understands how to talk to people. There's one thing that I hear from people who meet the president, like people who are like average humans like me who go to meet the president. And they're like, he gives you his attention. He talks to you. He listens to you. He makes you feel like you were important enough in that conversation for him to be giving you that attention, which I think is a very valuable thing. But he knows what he's doing. You talk about the art of the deal. Look at how he's tweeting and how he's speaking about Kim Jong-un. Look at how he's tweeting and speaking about China right now in Hong Kong. He has not come out and condemned China and their military response to what's going on in Hong Kong, because he's trying to get a deal done with China. And if he goes out and says President Xi is out of his mind and democracy forever, then he might lose ground in that deal-making process. A lot of people are saying, well, holy smokes, folks, I think that we are actually needing to stand up for democracy, and I think that we need to make a stand here for the people who are of Hong Kong who are being oppressed. Well, It's definitely something that the president has in the back of his mind, and he cares a whole lot less about how you and I feel in this specific moment than he cares about getting that ultimate deal done with China. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about rhetoric. I'm going to talk a little bit more about what politicians today are doing in an effort to get elected, but I'm also going to talk about what politicians and their pundits and this agenda-driven media is doing to try to get President Trump defeated. It's not so much about somebody else winning. It's about getting Donald Trump out of office and having him lose. Droy Murdoch is a contributor to National Review. He's a founding member of the Project 21 and he's a Fox News contributor. He's going to join us next, and he's going to talk about the racist tones, the rhetoric that is used at the president to illustrate him as some sort of racist individual, and how he doesn't buy that at all. And I think it's a really interesting piece he's got right up at National Review right now. It says, don't ignore Trump's unifying anti-racist rhetoric. How much are you hearing about that from anybody? Droy Murdoch's going to join us in just a minute, about 3 minutes from now. And he's going to talk to us about how he sees this president and this president's rhetoric and how badly this media is getting it. Judge Napolitano joins us as well at 1:40. So we've got a packed 1 o'clock hour for you. Stick with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Annie Fry Show.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
I believe that racism, and this committee should look at this. You're not a criminal justice committee, but you're dealing with the impact on religious institutions, should be declared a national security threat. Racism is a national security threat. Before, we would say, you have a right to your racist views. You have a right to believe that slavery was right, that segregation was right. We live in an era where that can no longer be allowed.
That's Sheila Jackson Lee wants to make racism a national security threat, imploring her colleagues in the House to acknowledge the national security threat that racism is today. I'm going to talk to our guest now about it. Founding member of the Project 21 and a Fox News contributor, also contributor to National Review, DeRoy Murdoch joins us now. DeRoy, great to have you back on the show.
Hey, great to be with you.
So I'm listening to Sheila Jackson Lee there. She's imploring her colleagues there to recognize racism as a national security threat. And you can't go probably 10 or 15 minutes of watching the mainstream media without hearing something that is just a given, that this president is a racist. It's the way he is. It's the way he always has been. Is this a thought out process by these individuals to label him as this? Or is this something he's rightfully earned?
Oh, you know, he's a racist just like the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. I mean, it's as axiomatic as that. It's an unbendable law of physics, or at least that's what they'd like you to believe. I think now that the Russia story has collapsed, that's gone nowhere. Impeachment may not go anywhere. So now they've all decided, okay, let's just change the talking points to racism, 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 racism. And they just say it all the time. And as Dr. Goebbels of Nazi Germany taught us, if you repeat the big lie long enough and frequently enough and loudly enough, people eventually will believe it's true. And the big lie the Democrats and the left are pushing is that Trump is a racist. Why? Well, because he's a racist, and that's pretty much the extent of it. It's ugly, it's nasty, it's unbelievably divisive, totally unfair, and it's just one more thing that they're doing that's tearing our country to pieces.
Well, I'm reading through this National Review article that you wrote, and people can see DeRoy Murdoch's contributions to National Review at nationalreview.com. And you have an article called Don't Ignore Trump's Unifying Anti-Racist Rhetoric. The one thing when I have callers reach out to my show and they say, you got to admit, Donald Trump's a racist. And I ask them for examples. It often ends up in the conversation of, well, he hasn't done enough to renounce it. You're here suggesting that the president has offered unifying and anti-racist rhetoric.
Over and over and over and over again. I have in this article 25 different examples of when he either has denounced racism, denounced white supremacy, denounced anti-Semitism, spoken up favorably about blacks, favorably about Jews, said warm things about Muslims, hosted an iftar dinner, which is a dinner you do at the end of after sundown on Ramadan. None of this gets covered in the media. In fact, I think they cover up a lot of this. And like I say, at least 24 times I'm aware of that he's done exactly what the media and the left say, which is, we want you to unify us, say something positive, say something to isolate and condemn white nationalism. He does it again and again and again, and they don't give him credit for it. Or what they'll do is they'll say, well, he read something off a teleprompter. He doesn't really believe it. So the goalpost always moves. First, he's never said it, and then he said it, but he doesn't really believe it, and so on. Or they just pretend he didn't do it, and they cover it up. Best example I can give you on this was after the attack at Poway Synagogue near San Diego. You may recall that was about 3-4 months ago. A gunman went in and shot up a bunch of people, killed several. The rabbi was injured but not killed, and a few days later, the President of the United States had him at the White House. And he was in the Rose Garden, Rabbi Israel Goldstein, and the President said at that time, we forcefully condemn the evil of anti-Semitism and hate, which must be defeated. Rabbi Goldstein was in the Rose Garden and thanked the President for his phone call, which was the day of the attack. He said, I was crying, I was mourning. My healing didn't begin until you, Mr. President, called and started my healing. He said, you're a mensch par excellence. And there was the President of the United States there with the Rabbi Goldstein from that synagogue. His hands are bandaged because his fingers, several of his fingers have been shot off by this gunman in the Rose Garden. Very moving, very touching. Guess how much time that story got on ABC, CBS, and NBC Nightly News that evening?
Yeah, hardly any, because I remember you, as you're telling that story, I can remember the existence of that, but it certainly wouldn't be the lead headline or anywhere near it if someone were to retell the story of the aftermath of that horrific incident.
Oh, I wish it were that good. The answer to the question is zero. They spent 0 minutes and 0 seconds.
Wow.
Now, they easily could have said, look, we don't like Trump. We're going to run 10 seconds of tape and let the anchor say, at the Rose Garden, President Trump met with a Rabbi Goldstein of the Poway Synagogue. They had a very warm meeting. In other news, no, they didn't do that. They spent 0 minutes, 0 seconds at a time when Jews in this country were terrified, thinking, oh, my God, is anti-Semitism erupting again? Gentiles are feeling sorry for the Jews in that situation. The whole country's tense. What you want is when the president tries to unify the country, the three major networks provide that story so people are comforted and also so that anti-Semites know, gee, I guess if President Trump is meeting with a rabbi, he's really not on our side, the side of the anti-Semites, so maybe we should stop doing what we're doing. They didn't put that out. And by keeping the president's message against anti-Semitism from reaching the ears of anti-Semites, what the major media do is make it easier for them to do what they do, conduct their evil, believe their awful thoughts, because as far as they're concerned, the president doesn't care about it.
You know,
but in fact, he cared enough to have that rabbi there, and the major news networks covered up that story that evening. Yeah. Horrible, disgusting malpractice on the part of America's media.
Malpractice, you know, at best, and there's much worse that could be said about that. I was going to ask you if you believe that the racial tensions in this country are worse now than they have been in the past, but I was initially going to ask you that question in the context of Donald Trump. But I think that you've kind of answered my question in that it may be worse now than it has been before, but the blame might not rest with Donald Trump, where the left directly points to that blame.
Well, you know, again, when he says the sorts of stuff that he does and they don't talk about it, it allows people to think that things are worse than they really are, or the president's certainly worse than he is. For example, his very first speech to Congress, he said, we may be a nation divided on policies. We are a country that stands united in condemning hate and evil in all its very ugly forms. The day of the Charlottesville attack, it was in fact 2 years ago today, as the attack started, about 10:15 in the morning, when the riots began, he said racism, I believe this was a statement he made, August 14th, racism is evil, and those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans, unquote. He actually said that a couple of days after the riots. I mean, that is as clear a denunciation and renunciation and condemnation of white supremacy, KKK, and the neo-Nazis as anybody would want. They never talk about that. They just say, oh, he eggs these people on. He encourages them. I don't know how you encourage people by saying that they are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans.
Yeah.
That doesn't really encourage you as a white supremacist to keep doing what you're doing.
Absolutely. We're speaking with Droy Murdoch, as a founding member of Project 21, also a Fox News contributor. I don't know about your personal experience with the president or people who you know who have personal experience with this president, but is there, from people who come to this president, they happen to be a minority, that the stories that I hear tend to be that he is very welcoming and very open to the conversations that exist around discussing these kinds of topics and how to make an effort to make the community better for, you know, some of the poverty-stricken areas that might be minorities, which there are plenty of poverty-stricken areas that are completely white. But also, you look at the job market and the jobs that become available, that helps rise all ships. And so your experience with the president or people who you know in that person-to-person communication, how he relates to that?
I've never met the man. I actually met the man very briefly once at a 4th of July event, actually. But I can't say I know him very well. But the people I know who are minority members speak very highly of him. They say he's very warm and friendly and cordial. You are correct that black unemployment, Hispanic unemployment are close to record low levels ever because of the tax cuts, deregulations, other policies that he's implemented. But there's some specific things he's done that are disproportionately helpful to minorities. One is, I believe, about 6 weeks after he came to the White House, he had in the Oval Office about 36 presidents of historically black colleges and universities. He announced that he was going to open an office in the White House to help those historically black colleges and universities navigate the federal bureaucracy, receive whatever kind of aid they could. One of the things that they wanted was for Pell Grants to be available for summer school. Apparently a lot of the students go to summer school. They wanted Pell Grants to cover that, and they asked Obama about it for 8 years. He didn't do anything about it, and guess what? Donald J. Trump, this alleged racist, said, okay, we'll make Pell Grants available for summer school. So they got that. He signed the Criminal Justice Reform Bill, the First Step Act. This is something that, of all people, Black Lives Matter had been pushing, which is something which allows people who are nonviolent criminals to get out of prison if they meet certain conditions. That has a disproportionate effect on Black prisoners and Black families. That's a good thing for Black folks. If he hated Black people, he wouldn't have done that. If he hated Black people, I don't think he would have signed the Opportunity Zone Bill, which is part of the tax reform, tax cut effort. And this will, I think it's something like 8,000 or 9,000 poor, low-income communities in the United States, many of them Black, will be able to get various incentives to make it easier to start businesses and have businesses thrive in those areas. If he hated Black people, I don't think he would have included that in the tax cut bill. Those are just a couple of examples. And, of course, he campaigned in a charter school in Cleveland in 2016. He was at a Black church in Detroit, Black church in Flint, Michigan. And he said in the fall campaign, he'd say over and over again to Black voters, vote for me, what the hell do you have to lose? That's actual slogan he used. He held up signs that said, Blacks for Trump. It goes on and on and on. And the reason that this may come as a total shock to your listeners right now is the media don't want to talk about this. They cover this up, and all they do is scream racism at the tops of their lungs. That's what the left does. That's what the Democrats do. And the left-wing media are more than happy to cover this stuff up, keep it concealed, and let America think that we're run by basically a Klansman in a blue suit, which is A, not true, and B, leads to the kind of tension and division basically social crisis, if you will, that we're experiencing in this country right now.
Dory, I've got about 30 seconds here, but the big question is that message getting into those minority communities? Are they seeing the facts as you list them and how this administration is benefiting everybody?
Nowhere to the degree they should. I think the president needs to campaign in Black neighborhoods. They ought to be running ads and Black entertainment television, Black-oriented websites. This story needs to get out there, and the mainstream media are not going to get it out there. He needs to push this himself, and the best thing he can do is show up at as many Black churches, Black businesses, Black town halls, what have you, as he can between now and the election.
Dory Murdoch, a founding member of Project 21 and also a Fox News contributor, joining us now. Great to speak with you, Dory. We really appreciate your insight, and we look forward to the next time.
Very good. Thanks, Annie. Take care now.
You too.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to speak with Judge Napolitano. Now, we haven't been inundating you with Jeffrey Epstein stuff because, first of all, it's gross. And second of all, with his apparent suicide over the weekend, a lot of questions surrounding what could happen next. I, for one, think that they should just go full throttle ahead and try to find every person who was ever involved in helping him do what he did and use the services that he would provide people access to. I'm going to ask Judge Napolitano about those legal issues. How does this continue to go on now that the person who was originally indicted is dead? What happens next? If you have questions for Judge Napolitano, tweet them at me at Annie Fry Show, and I will check them out on Twitter right now over the break at Annie Fry Show. Questions about Jeffrey Epstein and his death and what that means for justice going forward. Judge Napolitano with us in 5 minutes. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to The Annie Fry Show.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome back to the Annie Fry Show. Great to be with you. Hope you're enjoying this beautiful day here in St. Louis. Finally got some agreeable weather and hope you were able to enjoy it. We've been following the Jeffrey Epstein saga as it has been unfolding and taking a lot of twists and turns along the way. And there's no better person to talk to you about the legal aspects of this than Judge Napolitano, who joins us now. He's Fox News senior judicial analyst. Judge, great to have you on today.
Thank you, Annie. Nice to be with you, as always.
Well, okay, so let's get started here with Jeffrey Epstein. I think there are two main questions that people have about what happens next, and I'm going to ask them to you one at a time. The first one is, how do we get justice for Epstein's victims now? Now that he's dead and he was indicted and he's dead, so as I understand it, the indictment dies with him. What happens next?
Well, the state of New York has enacted a statute which has removed the statute of limitations from civil lawsuits alleging sexual abuse. But stated differently, the victims, who are now presumably grown women, can file lawsuits today for events that occurred 20 years ago and bring an action against the estate. The government takes the position, the government, that it is not its job, and that's the law, it's not its job under the law to seek redress for the victims. Its job is to seek redress for the United States of America when someone uses channels of interstate commerce to transport human beings for illicit purposes. So stated differently, obviously you can't prosecute a dead person, and obviously you can't prosecute the person's estate, but the victims can bring lawsuits against that estate. The estate apparently has substantial assets. Mm-hmm. Now, the government is furious, and rightly so, over Epstein's death. And it is going to look very carefully at the people around Epstein who may have facilitated his scheme, as well as the males who may have participated in it. So the people alluded to in the indictment, employee one, employee two, employee three, and others known to the grand jury but unnamed, I'm quoting from the indictment, may very well be the subject of investigations by the federal government, which would simply need to amend its complaint, its indictment against Epstein, and name these people as defendants. But I think their greatest fear, whoever they are, is the civil litigation, because anybody can allege anything in civil litigation, and their backs will be to the wall. It'll be their word against the female's word. You're talking about expensive, embarrassing, because these are public people, many of them, civil litigation in which substantial damages will be sought.
We're speaking with Judge Napolitano, Fox News' senior judicial analyst. The second question that I had for you kind of spoke towards a little bit, but what role does the Department of Justice now have in investigating the nature of Jeffrey Epstein's death? There are a lot of questions, a lot of theories out there, but how does the Department of Justice go about investigating what happened, if it's an apparent suicide or maybe something else?
Well, there are three investigations at the present time. The FBI is investigating everything surrounding his death. The Bureau of Prisons itself is investigating what administrative regulations may have been violated. And the Inspector General of the Department of Justice is investigating what Justice Department employees may have failed to do their jobs. Now, one can fail to do one's job, but not technically violate an administrative regulation. I'll give you an example. Falling asleep on the job. I mean, the regulations prohibit falling asleep, and presumably, unless they fell asleep intentionally, they wouldn't be prosecuted for it. On the other hand, falsifying federal records, claiming you visited his cell every 30 minutes when, in fact, you didn't. Normally, that is an administrative regulation that's addressed in an administrative hearing. The guard, the correction officers, labor union would hire lawyers to defend them, and if it was found that they did falsify records, then they'd lose a week's pay or a week vacation. Not so this time. Falsifying records is a felony and will be treated as such. So if the FBI investigation shows evidence of falsifying records, whoever falsified those records will most likely be indicted for that felony and could very well end up in the very institution as an inmate, as a detainee,
yikes,
in which they once worked, this is terrible, in which they once worked as a corrections officer.
Yeah, that's
so the bottom line is the government is going to be very aggressive because its case has been ruined with Epstein's death. I mean, I believe that Epstein and his lawyers were about to negotiate with the government, and in return for a guilty plea and a substantial reduction from his maximum of 45 years down to something livable and tolerable in his own mind, he was going to name names. Well, now he's dead. I mean, the lawyers can name the names, but they can't provide the evidence because Epstein is the only person who can say, I saw so-and-so do this, and I helped so-and-so do that.
So you talk about those names. We had heard of some names just this past weekend before the suicide had happened. But we know that there's been a raid on his island. If they were to find evidence that exists outside of the testimony of Jeffrey Epstein, do those people who have been named or people who have been associated with Jeffrey Epstein, do they still have a criminal legal problem ahead of them?
Well, it would depend upon when the criminal acts occurred. There is no statute of limitations on the sexual assault or the transportation trafficking, it's called, for sexual purposes of minors. But that statute of limitations went away in 2006. So if they find evidence on the island of this behavior pre-2006, it's too late to prosecute these people. But if they find it in 2006 or afterwards, they can all be prosecuted. Florida, which I gather is the state of where his island is, if it is Florida, if it's the Virgin Islands, I don't know what the law is, but I doubt that the law is this limitless statute of limitations that we have in New York. So stated differently, in order for somebody to sue in 2019 for an assault that took place in 2006, there would have to be evidence that that assault took place in New York, not in Florida or the Virgin Islands. So it's going to be fact-specific for each potential defendant about who's exposed to criminal prosecution, who's exposed to civil liability, and who's not exposed to anything. For many of these people, the exposure will consist in the credible allegations against them. I mean, for example, I don't want to mention names, but the well-known named people, their accuser is the same person that the government was going to put on the stand to testify against Epstein. Mm. That means the government believes this accuser and has already had her testify before a grand jury and vouches for her credibility. I don't see this stuff going away.
Judge, this is Tony Colombo. It's kind of funny that in a roundabout way, the movie The Godfather has been in the news this week because of the ridiculousness with Andrew Cuomo and that, you know, being about mob hits and things like that. And then we talk about this story with Epstein and the conspiracy theories that go along with something like this. I've seen some very credible pundits that are not conspiracy theory people on television saying, man, I understand this one. I understand why people believe that they it's just funny. It's just amazing all the things that went wrong or lined up. How much credibility do you give some of these conspiracy theories that this was, you know, some sort of an inside job to silence him before he, you know, could expose people? How much credibility do you give those types of theories in this story?
Well, I don't give them any. I think the president's retweeting of this nonsense that Bill and Hillary had him killed was irresponsible and absurd, mm-hmm. but that's the way the president chooses to behave. But look, the autopsy results will reveal the time and manner of his death. Was there a struggle? Did he change his mind at the last minute? Was there another person there? Is there some, did his body show that his fingers touched another person? What caused the shutdown of his organs? Was it a loss of blood? Was it a loss of oxygen? Was it trauma? All these things are going to be revealed sooner or later in the autopsy. It is unusual that cameras were off. Hospitals in New Jersey, when they have a dangerous patient, dangerous to himself or dangerous to other patients, have a little camera in the room. It's the size of a quarter dollar. You can't even see it from the bed. They don't have to watch a screen. The camera has software in it that if the person tries to get out of bed, an alarm goes off. This is very inexpensive. You could buy this for your home, for your children. You're telling me that the Bureau of Prisons didn't have it, or if it had it, it didn't have it turned on? These things feed conspiracies. But prisons are lax, they are poorly managed, they are sloppy, horrific places that operate more on tradition and custom than they do on law. And I think the Attorney General, with all of his experience in the DOJ, is finally learning that.
Judge Napolitano, great to have you with us. Thank you so much for the insight. We look forward to talking to you again.
My pleasure, guys. All the best.
You as well. He's the Fox News senior judicial analyst on Twitter at Judge Knapp. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.